Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is the Federal News Update for Friday, November 28, 2025. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
Our mission today is a deep dive, a really rigorous, exhaustive, and thoroughly granular report on every significant action and activity of the U.S. federal government since Wednesday, November 26, 2025.
Right. And you might think, you know, Thanksgiving week, it's a quiet holiday lull.
But our sources confirm the exact opposite.
It was anything but a lull. I mean, while millions of Americans were traveling or getting ready for family gatherings, the administrative state, the White House, the judiciary, they were all exceptionally busy.
This period was really defined by this intense, highly coordinated executive and judicial maneuvering.
Yeah, and we're synthesizing everything from, you know, these subtle Supreme Court procedural moves all the way to massive new executive orders.
But we can't start with policy. We have to begin where the holiday calm was just violently shattered. On the streets of Washington, D.C.
Okay, let's unpack this immediately.
This was the most immediate high-impact event of the period. It happened Wednesday afternoon, November 26th, at around 2:15 local time.
And just blocks from the symbolic center of American power.
A brazen and truly tragic act. Two members of the West Virginia National Guard, who were deployed to the Capitol, were shot in what's being described as a targeted ambush.
The location itself is significant, near 17th and I Street, NW. That's the heart of downtown D.C.
Right near major office buildings, a metro stop. It's a very busy area.
Both guardsmen were rushed to the hospital in critical condition, and the chaos was, it was intense. Initial reports described first responders treating the wounded on a sidewalk just covered in glass.
And what's crucial here for understanding the whole security posture is the immediate response.
Exactly. The suspect was apprehended not just by police, but because other National Guard members who were in the area ran directly toward the gunfire.
They helped subdue the assailant, who was also shot during that exchange.
That just speaks volumes about the level of risk they're facing, you know, operating in what is essentially a civilian capacity.
And law enforcement officials, they've identified the suspect, Ramanullah Lakhanwal. He's an Afghan national who entered the U.S. back in September 2021.
And he was residing in Washington state.
Because the target was U.S. troops performing federal duties, this changes everything, legally speaking.
It does. FBI Director Kash Patel stated very clearly that the FBI will lead the investigation, treating it as an assault on a federal law enforcement officer.
And that legal distinction, it's not just semantics. It underscores the severity and federal nature of the crime.
Right. It immediately elevates it past a typical local police investigation. Director Patel urged prayers for the critically wounded troops, which really shows how visible this attack was.
The political reaction was, well, it was instantaneous. It came from the absolute highest levels of government.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who was actually traveling at the time.
He was in the Dominican Republic, right? For anti-drug trafficking efforts.
That's right. He announced that President Donald Trump had ordered an immediate deployment of 500 additional National Guard members to D.C.
And this wasn't just a procedural response, was it?
No, not at all. Secretary Hegseth linked the violence directly to the administration's determination to maintain the deployment. He said, "We will never back down. We will secure our capital."
Meanwhile, President Trump, posting from Florida on Truth Social, called the assailant an animal who would pay a steep price.
And crucially, he used the incident to pivot immediately to policy.
Immediately. He called for the reinvestigation of all Afghan refugees who were admitted under the Biden administration.
So this incident, it just reignited a highly controversial debate, and it moved it from, you know, a dry legal argument into a visceral life or death crisis.
The militarization of domestic law enforcement, the use of troops for civil duties, it's all right back on the front page.
We have to remember the context of that deployment.
Absolutely.
Back in August, President Trump used an emergency order to federalize the local D.C. police force and bring in National Guard troops from eight different states, including West Virginia. And that move was already under significant legal duress.
That's right. Just last week, a federal judge had ruled this entire deployment illegal, citing separation of powers and local authority.
But the ruling was on a 21-day hold, pending an appeal.
Exactly. So that meant the troops were operating in D.C. while their very presence was, well, legally precarious.
The moment of the shooting just highlights that contradiction perfectly. And what were they doing? I mean, they weren't fighting off an invasion.
No. Reports show they were performing these highly varied, low-level duties, patrolling neighborhoods, operating checkpoints at train stations.
Even things like trash pickup and guarding sports events. General Stephen Nordhaus, the chief of the National Guard Bureau, he had to scrap his plans to visit troops at Guantanamo Bay just to fly to D.C. to be with the Guard members here.
So the implication analysis here is stark. This ambush transforms the political debate over the Guard presence. It's no longer a technical legal question about federal authority.
Now it's an immediate justification for increasing that very presence.
And at the same time, it provides immediate, high-impact political fodder for the administration to justify sweeping changes to immigration policy and refugee vetting processes.
Changes they have long sought. It's a calculated crisis, exploited instantly.
It's a profound shockwave. And it's rippling through a period that was supposed to be a national pause.
And when we talk about the strain, the contrast between the danger faced by those troops and the civilian experience of the federal government during this same period, it creates an almost absurd paradox.
Which brings us to what we're calling the Thanksgiving travel paradox. While Guard members are in critical condition, the civilian-facing parts of the federal government were, at the same time, setting records for performance.
During peak demand, no less.
We are witnessing what the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, is calling the highest volume travel passenger period in history.
And the sheer scale of that logistical challenge is just, it's hard to overstate.
The TSA expected to screen over 17.8 million people. That's from Tuesday, November 25th through Tuesday, December 2nd.
An unprecedented level of demand placed on an agency that, you know, earlier this year saw significant operational turmoil.
Especially after that recent 43-day government shutdown that strained resources and, as we'll get to, delayed pay.
But here is where the analysis gets really complex. Despite all that tumult, despite the massive workforce downsizing across government that we'll discuss, customer satisfaction scores related to federal services are hitting a two-decade high.
The latest American Customer Satisfaction Index scorecard shows these historic highs. 94% confidence in TSA's ability to keep air travel safe.
And 93% satisfied with the screening experience itself.
So how is that possible? It's completely counterintuitive. How can a system under so much strain, managing historic volume, achieve these high marks?
The insight from the data is telling. The key driver of this improved satisfaction wasn't speed, which is what we usually focus on during peak travel. It was the officer's professionalism and respect. And this improvement can be traced back to mandatory training that the TSA implemented. They realized their lowest satisfaction scores consistently came from secondary screening.
When passengers don't understand why they're being delayed, or they feel disrespected.
Exactly. So it's a testament to the frontline personnel doing incredibly complex work under immense pressure.
It's a remarkable, if fragile, success story achieving high marks, even as the operational capacity of the federal government has been intentionally reduced.
But, and this is a big but, this success comes with a critical oversight gap.
Right. The government-wide customer experience, or CX, dashboard.
It's mandated to share public feedback data from over 40 federal services in real time, but it has not been updated since September 2024.
So wait, the federal government is achieving these historic high scores,
yeah.
But the public oversight mechanism designed to hold them accountable, it's lagging by months.
It's deliberately concealing a full picture of service performance at a time of record demand.
Precisely. It creates this fragile, high-stakes environment where we have to rely on snapshots of self-reported success without the continuous granular oversight the CX dashboard was designed to provide.
And that lack of transparency is a recurring theme.
And as we discuss the strain on the system, we have to circle back to the military community itself. We have to connect the operational reality of TSA's success to the domestic tragedy of that shooting.
Because the recent shutdown and overall economic pressures are creating acute hardship for the very people securing the Capitol.
Operation Homefront reported that food-related assistance requests for military families, and that includes Guard members, have surged an alarming 57% this year.
A 57% surge. The financial pressure, which was exacerbated by the shutdown and just general inflation, is pushing many service members into food insecurity.
They were distributing holiday meals this very week to D.C. Guard families. The same community whose members were shot just a few days ago.
It's a critical link. The federal government achieves high customer marks with the TSA, even as the internal capacity and financial support for its own personnel, the troops deployed in D.C., is experiencing tremendous strain.
Leading to massive spikes in requests for basic assistance.
The dots connect here to illustrate a deeply bifurcated state. a high-performance facade covering very real internal instability.
So that's the domestic front, a mix of violence, record demand, surprising success, and severe administrative strain. But the high-level activity from Wednesday onwards, that shows a decisive shift in strategy.
Let's shift focus to the constitutional and geopolitical consolidation that took place.
And here's where it gets, as you said, really interesting.
Because the White House is using these highly specific legal and bureaucratic maneuvers to effect massive constitutional change, we have to dissect the Supreme Court's actions on November 26, specifically regarding a case called Blanche v. Perlmutter.
Now, this sounds incredibly niche. A case about the Register of Copyrights, Shira Perlmutter. How is a copyright dispute a constitutional lever?
Okay, so the Supreme Court issued a miscellaneous order, and it deferred the application for a stay in this case. The case challenges the president's firing of Perlmutter and the subsequent appointment of Todd Blanche as the acting librarian of Congress.
Todd Blanche, who was President Trump's private defense attorney in 2024.
The very same. So the issue isn't really copyright. It's about presidential removal power.
And the deferral itself is legally profound, because the court explicitly linked Blanche to two other explosive cases.
Trump v. Slaughter, which is about firing an FTC commissioner, and Trump v. Cook, about removing a Federal Reserve governor.
That linkage is the heart of the strategic maneuver.
It is. By connecting these three cases, one dealing with a legislative agency, the Copyright Office, one with a regulatory agency, the FTC, and one with a financial independent agency, the court is signaling that it's treating them as a singular, unified constitutional question.
A question about the president's unlimited removal power over all officers of the United States.
This is the mechanism for fully affirming the unitary executive theory.
So the administration is basically arguing that because the Library of Congress, through the Copyright Office, issues regulations that bind the public,
the register exercises executive power and therefore must be removable by the president under Article 2, regardless of what Congress intended.
Exactly. And the Register of Copyrights is a perfect test case for them. Traditionally, this position, housed in the legislative branch, it's been insulated.
Right. So by leveraging a legislative agency as the trigger and arguing that any officer who promulgates rules that affect the public must be removable at will, they have forced a constitutional showdown.
A showdown that could dissolve the statutory independence of the entire fourth branch of independent agencies.
But wait, you might say, what about Justice Thomas's notation here? Isn't that just standard procedural boilerplate? How do we know this is a huge signal?
That's a great question, and it speaks to how you have to read the subtext of the court.
While it is standard, the specific notation that Justice Thomas would grant the application, that signals that at least one justice is ready to fully affirm the unitary executive theory now.
Without further waiting or briefing.
It suggests the administration has at least one vote ready to dismantle the independence of regulatory bodies like the Federal Reserve, the FTC, the SEC, and place them under the direct command of the White House.
It's a systematic, highly sophisticated effort to consolidate presidential control. And they're using a seemingly innocuous copyright position as the battering ram.
And this constitutional rearchitecture was running parallel to a truly fundamental restructuring of the nation's technological and scientific capacity,
which was executed through a newly published executive order. This is the Genesis mission.
EO-14363. It was signed earlier, but published on November 28. It establishes a radical state-directed innovation model.
The text itself explicitly calls it a national effort, akin to the Manhattan Project, operating primarily within the Department of Energy.
That comparison to the Manhattan Project immediately implies immense scale, secrecy, and speed.
So what defines this Genesis mission?
It's about technological sovereignty and state control over what you could call cognitive production. The central technical mandate is the creation of a closed-loop AI experimentation platform.
This is not just a computing cloud.
No. It requires the DOE to aggregate and essentially nationalize proprietary data sets, data generated from decades of research at all the national laboratories, places like Los Alamos, Oak Ridge, and Lawrence Livermore.
All into a single unified federal repository. So data nationalization, why is that necessary?
because this aggregated secure data will then be used to train sovereign scientific foundation models. These models must be distinct from commercial AI, like those from OpenAI or Google, for national security reasons, for data fidelity, and to avoid the risks that come with foreign-trained or commercially influenced models.
And the ultimate goal?
The deployment of robotic laboratories, where AI agents can hypothesize and execute experiments autonomously without direct human intervention. This is the definition of sovereign science: the state owning the entire means of discovery and production in critical scientific fields.
That is a staggering reorientation of research and development. What areas is it targeting?
The EO mandates the DOE identify 20 science and technology challenges. And the priority domains are the core of global competition and defense.
Advanced manufacturing, biotechnology, critical materials.
Right. Think rare earths and specialty alloys, nuclear fission and fusion, quantum information science, and of course, semiconductors. The administration is essentially building a security fence around American innovation and directing its output toward explicit national security goals.
So how does this massive state effort impact the private sector? What about the tech industry?
Well, it creates an immediate and substantial state customer. The order directs the DOE to identify computing resources from industry partners,
which positions major hardware and chip companies like NVIDIA and Dell to become quasi-defense contractors.
Exactly. They get guaranteed business, but they will inevitably face stricter security oversight and significantly reduced flexibility when it comes to exporting this kind of technology.
And what about the intellectual property? Who owns the discoveries made by these autonomous AI labs?
That's the billion-dollar question. And this technological mandate is legally coupled with the USPTO's new guidance on AI-assisted inventions, also published on November 28th.
So they're thinking ahead.
Incredibly forward-thinking. This guidance tries to tackle who owns the IP when an AI directs or substantially assists a discovery. Is it the human scientist, the AI owner, or the federal government that provided the foundation model and the compute?
It shows they're restructuring the science and immediately updating the IP law to secure the results for the state.
And from constitutional separation of powers and this new scientific industrial base, the White House also executed swift geopolitical shifts using the holiday cover.
Right. Two other executive orders published around the 28th reveal this strategy.
Ideological confrontation in the Middle East paired with economic pragmatism toward South America. First, Executive Order 13622, which directs the review process to designate specific chapters of the Muslim Brotherhood in Lebanon, Egypt, and Jordan as foreign terrorist organizations.
Within 45 days.
Within 45 days. And targeting specific chapters, not a blanket designation, is highly calculated.
It is. The designation aligns the U.S. completely with the Egyptian Sisi regime, which views the Brotherhood as its primary internal threat. This gives Cairo crucial geopolitical backing.
But the move is deeply provocative and risks destabilizing a key U.S. ally, Jordan.
Why Jordan specifically?
Because in Jordan, the Brotherhood operates a legal political wing called the Islamic Action Front. They are a powerful, if critical, player in the nation's political life. They hold seats in parliament.
So by mandating this FTO review, the U.S. is signaling an intent to pressure King Abdullah II to crack down on his main internal political opposition.
Which risks destabilizing the kingdom, a linchpin of stability in the Levant. That 45-day deadline for the report acts as diplomatic leverage. It's a sort of Damocles, allowing the administration to coerce concessions from regional allies.
Meanwhile, on the economic front, EO 14361, published on the 26th, modified the previous 40% tariff on Brazilian goods.
This is a classic example of a tactical policy retreat when faced with imminent domestic economic pain. The order vaguely cites initial progress in negotiations, but the primary implication is inflation management,
specifically related to the consumer goods basket.
It creates significant tariff exemptions for key consumer products, beef, coffee, and other agricultural goods.
Let's drill down on that economic calculus. Why those specific goods and why right now?
You can trace it directly to the consumer price index data. Brazil is an essential global supplier of both beef and coffee to the U.S. A 40% tariff on those staples would have caused immediate and highly visible spikes in household grocery prices.
The food at home component of CPI.
Right ahead of the Christmas holiday season. This decision shows the administration is willing to sacrifice total adherence to the America First tariff structure to insulate itself from politically damaging inflation concerns for the average consumer.
They're prioritizing the dinner table over total trade protectionism when the political costs get too high.
So we have constitutional levers pulled, a massive new AI directive, key foreign policy realignments all published during the holiday window.
Now let's shift to the ground floor. What's the operational reality for the federal workforce, the people tasked with implementing all of this change?
And that brings us to the serious, ongoing chaos related to workforce downsizing, back pay delays, and a fragile regulatory environment. The government's basic machinery is sputtering.
And the most immediate sign of this strain is the back pay nightmare. After the 43-day shutdown that ended November 13th, OPM targeted November 16th for DOD civilian back pay.
But nearly 2 weeks later, many DOD employees were still waiting.
The problem centers on these massive, outdated payroll systems used by the DOD, DFAS, primarily.
They're highly complex, often rely on manual inputs, old software. When the government shuts down, those systems have to be manually restarted, often with errors, and the sheer volume just overwhelmed the limited staff.
And the communication seemed to just break down entirely, which only amplified the anxiety.
Absolutely. Employees reported a complete lack of official written guidance. Supervisors were giving conflicting verbal estimates. We heard November 29th, but employees couldn't rely on it.
And worse, for the employees who did get paid, many reported major errors.
Incorrect taxing, missing deductions for insurance or retirement, and critically, not receiving a corresponding leave and earnings statement, an LES.
Which is essential. Without an LES, you can't verify if you were overtaxed, if your health insurance was deducted. It puts you in a state of financial uncertainty.
And we know these delays and errors directly contributed to that surge in demand for food assistance at Operation Homefront. The human cost of the back pay chaos is undeniable.
And this chaotic situation is happening at the same time the administration is aggressively trying to shrink the federal footprint overall.
Right. On November 26th, OPM issued a memo advising agencies to rethink their staffing needs for the highest echelon positions. Senior executive service, senior level, scientific professional positions, they want assessments by December 19th.
And the rationale is linked to the massive exodus this year, correct?
Precisely. OPM is arguing that with 317,000 employees having left service this year compared to only 68,000 new hires, well, that may lead to a corresponding reduction in the need for these senior executive positions.
So it's about cutting costs and ensuring the senior people who remain are laser focused on implementing presidential priorities.
And OPM also announced two significant new government-wide studies on the 26th.
Right. One on the implementation of the return to office policy.
And critically, one on the removal of diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility DEIA programs. These studies signal they're not just cutting quantity, but ensuring the political alignment of the remaining workforce.
But even as OPM pushes for this internal downsizing, a federal court blocked the administration's plan to scrap four small agencies.
That's the check on executive action. It indicates that the wholesale dismantling of the administrative state isn't proceeding entirely unchecked by the judiciary.
Let's look now at the granular regulatory shifts, the day-to-day mechanisms of policy.
The administrative state was busy, but one key action was actually a tactical retreat by the EPA. On November 26th, they withdrew a direct final rule.
Okay, what is a direct final rule and why do they have to withdraw it?
A direct final rule is a fast-track mechanism for non-controversial changes. The agency publishes the rule and says it'll become final unless they get any adverse comment.
And in this case, the rule would have extended compliance deadlines for coal-fired power plants to close their coal ash ponds, which is clearly controversial.
Correct. So the objection from presumably environmental groups or states, it instantly stalled that deregulation effort. It forces the EPA into a longer, full notice and comment rulemaking process.
A temporary win for opponents.
Contrast that with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC, which is moving full steam ahead.
They implemented a final rule effective November 26th, titled Streamlining Select Rules of Practice and Procedure.
This is highly synchronized with the Genesis mission's push for nuclear expansion. They're rescinding regulations deemed duplicative, proactively preparing the regulatory environment to facilitate rapid, large-scale nuclear development.
And we also saw the FDA ease requirements for certain medical technology.
Exactly. On the 26th, the FDA lowered the regulatory burden for the field generator positioning device, a neurological tech. They classified it as Class 1, the lowest level of regulation. This fits the general trend of easing market entry for medical devices.
So moving beyond workforce cuts and regulatory streamlining, let's explore the push for modernization and where the private sector interfaces with all this.
And specifically, the contracting chill.
The first, a clarification on the modernization architecture. A spokesperson for the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, rejected reports that the agency had ceased operations early.
Right, let's be clear on the names. The temporary Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, is working to sunset itself. The newly renamed U.S. DOGE service, which is the legacy of the U.S. Digital Service, is the permanent team.
And Amy Gleason is still the acting administrator there, moving forward with a very robust agenda.
It's a massive, highly visible slate of critical public services. They're using AI to process over 600,000 pieces of federal correspondence every month.
That's huge.
They're modernizing the FFSA system for 18 million students, transforming the non-immigrant visa process for the 2026 Olympics and World Cup, and trying to reduce those crushing delays for over 600,000 veterans a month on VA disability claims.
It sounds ambitious, but you just detailed an administration actively trying to cut staff, especially in technical ranks. How does that not create an impossible talent gap?
It does. Amy Gleason has repeatedly reiterated this concern. She's noted that agencies simply lack the necessary tech personnel. For example, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services
manages billions in health IT.
And at the start of the year, they had only about 13 engineers managing thousands of external contractors. There's a clear need to hire and empower talent, but this conflicts directly with the administration's workforce reduction goals.
A parallel, equally massive modernization effort is underway to tackle the government's credit portfolio.
Yes. A new organization, the Center for USA Lending, was established to modernize the government's credit portfolio, which is staggering. About $5 trillion across more than 125 different programs and 12 agencies.
$5 trillion. FHA loans, SBA loans, Department of Agriculture. What's a fundamental problem they're trying to solve?
Fragmentation and inefficiency. These systems are described as fragmented, outdated, complex. Different agencies use different legacy software, different criteria for risk, and the systems just don't talk to each other.
Which drives up costs, frustrates borrowers, and makes it hard to detect fraud.
Exactly. The center aims to bring centralized governance, data standardization, and technology like AI to streamline the whole experience from application to final payment.
But this push for efficiency within the government stands in very stark contrast to the climate of fear and uncertainty facing the contracting industry.
This is a major structural concern. The Professional Services Council, the PSC, is reporting a contracting chill. Federal agencies have largely stopped publishing procurement business forecasts.
And that information is absolutely critical for contractors to plan their strategies for 2026.
They can't allocate capital, hire personnel, or build big teams.
So why have these forecasts gone dark?
Two likely reasons, both tied to the downsizing. First, massive cuts to the contracting workforce. Some estimate over 25% means the human capacity to generate these forecasts is just gone.
And second,
the dismantling or de-emphasis of offices of small and disadvantaged business utilization, the OSDBUs, which often manage this forecasting data, it's created an operational vacuum.
So this isn't just a data gap. It's a crisis of confidence for the private sector.
It creates enormous uncertainty and risk. It may deter high-quality commercial companies from even bothering to engage in government work. The PSC found the forecasts so sparse this year, they skipped their annual market forecast entirely.
Let's move to our final section. Defense posture, accountability, and the judicial and political dockets.
Yeah.
And we have to begin with a serious look at accountability for veteran benefits.
A new Government Accountability Office, GAO, report found significant systemic oversight gaps related to veterans' disability medical exams.
And these exams are the foundation for determining benefits. The VA spends about $5 billion a year, and contractors do over 90% of the exams.
It's a quality control failure at a massive scale. The GAO identified three major problem areas. First, the Veterans Benefit Administration, the VBA, lacked effective procedures to review contractor corrective actions.
They weren't checking if the fixes were actually implemented.
Or if they were effective. And second, the VBA failed to conduct timely special focus reviews for complex high error rate issues.
Things like traumatic brain injury, military sexual trauma, Gulf War illness.
They were more than a year late on the scheduled two-year review cycle for these critical areas.
And the third area was financial errors.
Absolutely. The GAO found errors from manual data entry and flawed spreadsheet formulas used to determine contractor bonuses. These errors resulted in about $2.3 million in unearned bonuses being incorrectly paid out.
a direct consequence of reduced internal capacity.
And how did the VBA respond? They agreed in principle with the recommendations, but they noted they've cut staff by about 50% for this entire oversight function.
Which is why they're switching from a 2-year to a 3-year review cycle for those special focus exams.
It's a clear cause and effect for you, the listener. Staffing cuts create fraud opportunities and reduce quality control, directly impacting veterans' disability claims.
In the Defense and Foreign Policy Theater, we saw continued movement. Vice President Vance visited Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
Home of the 101st Airborne Division, he delivered a Thanksgiving message focused heavily on military readiness, solidifying the administration's bond with the military community.
And at the same time, major command transitions were finalized overseas.
A significant one in Naples, Italy, on November 26th. Admiral George Wyckoff assumed command of U.S. Naval Forces Europe-Africa. This puts him at the center of naval containment strategies in the Mediterranean Black Sea, managing high-stakes operations regarding Russia.
And we also saw logistical shifts in the U.S. military footprint in Europe.
The DoD made per diem rate changes effective December 1st. Specifically, they removed several Polish cities, Bydgoszcz, Kielce, Lodz, and Zakopane, from the specific allowance tables.
Which is a strong logistical signal.
It suggests a consolidation or shift in U.S. presence there, likely moving away from temporary rotational deployments toward fewer, larger, more permanent bases.
Finally, we turn to congressional activity and a high-stakes political targeting investigation.
Even during recess, the House Financial Services Committee prepared for a December hearing on the housing supply crisis. They're focusing on the Modular Housing Production Act.
Modular housing factory-built homes could increase supply quickly, but they face government roadblocks.
Especially with FHA financing and zoning. This bipartisan bill aims to reduce those barriers, aligning with the administration's deregulation goal.
And the Supreme Court's docket, beyond the massive constitutional question, reflected ongoing ideological battles.
On the 26th, the court docketed a procedural delay in a capital case, Louisiana v. Vannoy, and an extension in Sedev v. New Jersey State Bar Association.
The SATA case is noteworthy. It challenges state bar association authority,
which often serves as a vehicle for challenging compelled speech under the First Amendment. It's a priority for the conservative legal movement.
And the final activity we have to detail.
Yeah.
It's a truly serious escalation of partisan clashes into federal law enforcement happening just before Thanksgiving.
The FBI contacted security officials for the House and Senate to request interviews with 6 Democratic lawmakers. All of them are veterans or members of the intelligence community.
And they had appeared in a social media video urging U.S. troops to defy what they termed illegal orders.
This came right after President Trump's social media post accusing them of sedition, which he claimed was punishable by death.
The gravity of that accusation from the president cannot be overstated.
The Democratic lawmakers immediately called the inquiry, which was led by the FBI Counterterrorism Division, a scare tactic and an extraordinary escalation.
They argued that urging troops to reject illegal orders is something troops are already duty-bound to do.
Right, citing the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Even Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski publicly called the investigation frivolous. FBI Director Kash Patel would only say it was an ongoing matter.
So when you look back at the entire period, Wednesday through Friday, the constitutional rearchitecture, the Genesis missions, AI nationalization, the violence in D.C., the political targeting, it's clear the holiday was anything but quiet.
That's the critical takeaway. We saw the federal government simultaneously engaged in aggressive operational contraction, slashing the workforce, creating back pay chaos while executing monumental centralization.
The constitutional challenge against independent agencies and the Genesis mission, which nationalizes AI for state benefit, are two sides of the same strategy.
Consolidating command power and technological sovereignty in the executive branch.
And that centralization is running up against real, dangerous operational strain. The back pay chaos, the contracting chill, the serious oversight gaps at the VA where staff cuts are forcing a measurable reduction in quality reviews.
The state is attempting to do more with less, but the human cost and the risk of operational failure are undeniably rising.
So what does this all mean for you, the learner, moving forward? The period from November 26th to 28th, 2025, wasn't a holiday lull. It was a demonstration of a definitive, highly coordinated executive protocol.
The American state is rapidly reshaping itself along a few critical vectors: technological sovereignty, unitary command, and a reduced yet highly specialized administrative capacity. The question now is, which of these vectors will fully define the decade ahead, and what new institutions or what new failures will emerge in the wake of this rapid, intentional change?